Your next speaker is Avon Malone.
If you're concerned about reaching those that are outside of Christ, and that ought to be the concern of all of us, then there are some tremendously practical lessons for us in the first 12 verses of 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. We've been studying from the 1 Thessalonian letter. We looked in our first lesson at 1 and 3 as Paul gives thanks for your work of faith and labor of love and patience of hope. And then last Lord's Day evening, we looked at chapter 1, 9, and 10, where Paul said, "You turn from idols to God, to serve the living and true God, and to wait for His Son, whom He raised from the dead, even Jesus, who delivers us from the wrath to come." These have been our lessons thus far. Tonight we move into chapter 2, and to appreciate this chapter, you need to understand that Paul has some opponents in Thessalonica. When you read about the establishment of the church there, you find that there was a hostile Jewish element that forced him out of the synagogue after about 3 Sabbath days of preaching there, and assaulted the house of Jason, and ultimately drove Paul out of Thessalonica. And apparently this same element is still active. The Christians there have not been taken in by their attack. They have not been victimized, they have not succumbed to accepting and believing some of the things that were being said. But there's been what some have called a sort of whispering campaign toward Paul and Silas and Timothy, the missionaries that had worked together in Thessalonica. There seems to be an attempt to categorize them and to remember that in the Roman Empire at this time, particularly the Greek part of it, and Thessalonica is up in Macedonia, the northern part of Greece, Macedonia in the north, Achaia in the south. In that part of the first century world, there was a great love for the rhetorician, for the orator, for the debater, for the speaker. And as a result of that, there developed a group of people who took advantage of that. Oily-tongued orators and self-seeking pseudo-philosophers who would come in and fleece the flock, so to speak, and then flee. Who would take advantage of the fact that the Greek mind enjoyed the mental hike of a discussion or a debate. And so you had fellows who would make the better cause seem the worse, or the worse cause seem the better for a fee. They would argue either side of anything for a fee. And you can look at historical materials that will pretty well document the fact that you had this kind of character on the scene, particularly in the Greek part of the empire. The opponents of Paul and his co-workers try to shove them into that kind of stereotype, into that kind of pigeonhole. And I think in this part of the letter, we're reading Paul's response to that kind of attack. Will you read with me in your Testament at 1 Thessalonians chapter 2? We'll begin with verse 1, and we'll read on down through the 12th verse. "For yourselves, brethren, know our entering in unto you, that it has not been found vain. But having suffered before and been shamefully treated, as ye know, at Philippi, we wax bold in our God to speak unto you the gospel of God in much conflict. For our exhortation is not of error, nor of uncleanness, nor in guile. But even as we've been approved of God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak. Not as pleasing men, but God, who proveth our hearts. For neither at any time were we found using words of flattery, as ye know, nor a cloak of covetousness, God is witness, nor seeking glory of men, neither from you nor from others, when we might have claimed authority as apostles of Christ. But we were gentle in the midst of you, as when a nurse cherisheth her own children." I think the NIV would have it, a nursing mother cherishing her own children. "Even so," verse 8, "even so, being affectionately desirous of you, we were well pleased to impart unto you not the gospel of God only, but also our own souls, because you were become very dear to us. For ye remember, brethren, our labor and travail, working night and day, that we might not burden any of you, we preached unto you the gospel of God. Ye're witnesses, and God also, how righteously, how holy and righteously and unblameably we behaved ourselves toward you that believe. As you know, how we dealt with each one of you as a father with his own children, exhorting you and encouraging you and testifying, to the end that you should walk worthily of God, who calleth you into his own kingdom and glory. Paul, by some, not within the body, but this hostile Jewish element outside the body, has been looked upon as a time server, as a man pleaser. Here's a fellow who is seeking to win the praise and plaudits of the people. He's out to feather his own nest. He's out to fatten his own purse. He's come. He was here briefly. He's gone. Later in the chapter, Paul will say, I purpose to come unto you, I, Paul, once and again, and Satan hindered us. These opponents were probably saying, see, he's left. He hasn't come back. Paul says, I really haven't been gone very long. I've been bereaved of you for a short season. Verse 17, later in the chapter. And I purpose to come back, I, Paul, once and again. But Satan hindered me. But they're saying, look, he came here for a little while. He brings this pernicious doctrine, they would say, and he leaves you to catch the brunt of whatever this is going to bring upon you. And really, he's just like all these others that we've seen. These pseudo-philosophers, these oily-tongued orators, he's come in, he's fleeced the flock, he's taken advantage of you, he's won a following, he's gained something monetarily, perhaps, they imply, and that's not true, and Paul answers that decisively, and then he's gone. Notice how Paul begins to build his answer to this. Yourselves, brethren, know, this is common knowledge, you're well aware of the facts of the case, are entering in unto you, an expression used in the close of the previous chapter that could describe the entrance of the Greek actor into the drama, are entering in that it has not been found vain. Earlier this afternoon, I was looking at the splendid commentary Brother Kelsey did on the Thessalonian letters. He pointed out that the word vain here means empty. Our coming to you was not a pointless, purposeless venture on our part. It was not empty, but we came with your best good at heart. It was not the aimless, empty, vain activity of the adventurer who is simply out seeking his own interest. Our entering in was not vain, was not empty. But having suffered before and been shamefully treated at Philippi, as you know. How does that fit into the argument? Well, before preaching in Thessalonica, Paul had preached at a place there in Macedonia about 100 miles away, at Philippi. And you know the story in Acts chapter 16. Paul cast a spirit of divination out of a slave girl in Philippi. And that strikes her owners right in the pocketbook, and they have Paul and Silas unjustly beaten, thrust in the inner prison. Their feet are made fast in the stocks, and that sets the stage for the interesting dramatic conversion of the jailer. But notice, Paul had his back beaten. Paul was imprisoned. Paul was shamefully treated. What's the point of that? Hey, I'm not a time server. I'm not out pleasing men. Look at what I suffered in Philippi, and then I come to Thessalonica, and the house of Jason is assaulted. If you look at what's been happening to me, you know the charges are not true. I've been imprisoned, I've been beaten. Right before coming to Thessalonica, I endured all of that. Now, rather than simply go on through the section and discuss each verse or each expression, I want us to think of three things that would be very applicable to all of us who are concerned about trying to reach others. The attitude for the missionary, the attitude for the soul winner, the attitude for the teacher, the preacher, we have it in this passage. The passage is perhaps not as well known as the 2 Timothy 4 passage, Preach the Word. But there is really hardly a better passage in the New Testament to deal with the motives and the manner of life of that one who would teach others than this passage. I want us to think about three things. Paul's message of life, Paul's manner of life, and number three, Paul's motive of life, as we have it here. And if we get that down, we have a lesson for ourselves. We also have Paul's answer. Let's look at his message. Let's look at his manner of life and the motivation of his life. The message of life, the manner of life, and the motivation of Paul's life. Look with me at verse 4 with regard to the message. The message tells me something about the answer to these charges. Verse 4. But even as we have been approved of God to be entrusted with the gospel,
So we speak, not as pleasing men, but God, who proveth our hearts. The previous verse will help us some on the message. Our exhortation is not of error, nor of uncleanness, nor in guile. Verse 4, we've been entrusted. We've been approved of God to be entrusted with the gospel. The word gospel translates the word euangelion. And that word means good news, good message. The prefix eu means good, angelion means message. And so we've been approved of God to be entrusted with the gospel, the good news of Christ, the good news that He died for our sins, was buried and raised according to the Scriptures. Paul came with a message that saved the soul. It was not a message that Paul preached because it provided some great personal and immediate benefit to Paul. He preached it at his own peril. The Jews and the Judaizers strongly, vigorously opposed that message. And pagan Rome and polytheistic Greece were not ready to bow to that particular message. The very nature of the message upholds what Paul says here when he says that we were not pleasing men but God who trieth our hearts. A man-pleaser wouldn't go about preaching the cross. The message was the gospel. He'd been entrusted with the gospel. Look again at verse 4. Even as we've been approved of God to be entrusted with the gospel. And that's exactly and precisely our situation. We've been entrusted with the gospel. In a world that's lost, in a world that lies in the evil one, in the language of John, in a crooked and perverse generation, in Paul's language, Philippians 2, we've been entrusted with the gospel. That's been committed to us, and we're stewards. You remember the statement of Paul in 1 Corinthians 4, 2? It's required of stewards that a man be found faithful. Our great task is to be faithful to this stewardship. The message of life preached by Paul is our message. The good news of Jesus Christ. There's no other hope. Nothing else will save the world. Political prognostications, travel logs, book reviews, they won't save. The decrees of pontiffs and councils, synods and conventions, these will not save. The good news of Christ will save, and we've been entrusted with the gospel. Look at what he says in verse 3. Our exhortation is not of error, nor of uncleanness, nor of guile. The word exhortation is kin to the word for comforter in John chapter 14. I'm going to send another comforter. The word for comforter there is parakletos. The word for exhortation is paraklesis. We can tell even from the similarity of sound and spelling that those words are kin to each other. Exhortation is Paul's summary word for the preaching here, for the message. But notice it tells us something about the message. It's a message of comfort. It's a message that comes to weary hearts with hope. There is forgiveness. There is grace. There is comfort. It's gospel. It's good news. And so Paul is not self-seeking. And the very nature of the message indicates that. We've been entrusted with the gospel. It's a wonderful thing to be entrusted if we're trustworthy. It's a wonderful thing to have something committed to our stewardship if we'll remember it's required of stewards that a man be found faithful. Let's look at the big thing in this passage. The message of life, that's the gospel, verse 4. This exhortation, this message of comfort, that is not of error nor of uncleanness. It might surprise some to know that the word there translated uncleanness can mean moral impurity, even sexual impurity. Some of those who had to do with the Greek religions, this would be particularly true down to the south in Corinth, were impure in that way. And there may have even been a hint of that in the charges brought against Paul. But our exhortation was not of uncleanness, was not of error, nor of uncleanness, nor of guile. And that word means to catch with bait. And it suggests deceit. Paul said that was not characteristic of us. We do not fit in the category of the pseudo-philosophers and the unscrupulous Greek orators. Now then, number 2, the manner of life. And that's the big thing in this paragraph. When I teach this in school, we test over it. Now, I can't do that here, can I? And I say, watch for verse 10. Why? Because that really sums up a whole lot of the paragraph. Ye are witnesses and God also. That's pretty good testimony, isn't it? That's going to stand up in most any court. Under Moses' law, you had to confirm a thing at the mouth of two or three witnesses. You're witnesses and God also. You know the truth of this because you were there. You saw us. And God knows the truth of it. And Paul calls upon God to witness the truth of this. You're witnesses and God also. how holily and righteously or justly, in one translation, and unblameably we behaved ourselves in the midst of you. Here are these missionaries, Paul, Silas, Timothy, with them for a short time. Paul working with his hands. The charge that he came to feather his own nest couldn't be true. Paul didn't accept support from these people. Look at the next verse. In labor and travail, we work night and day that we might not burden you, that we might not be chargeable to you. That has a parallel in 2 Thessalonians chapter 3 at verses 8 and 9. Paul, using some of the same vocabulary, insists that we did not accept support at all from you. And you know how holily and justly and unblameably we behaved ourselves in your midst. The power is in the message. The power is not in the messenger. But how tragic it is when the life of the messenger causes the message to be disparaged, to be depreciated, to be taken lightly. And there were those in Thessalonica who would try to discredit the message by discrediting the messengers and say, look, these are like the others that we've seen. And they just came in and took advantage of the situation. They won the praise and plaudits of the people. They fattened their own purse and now they're gone. And Paul said, that's not true and you know it and God knows it. You're witnesses and God also. How holily and justly and unblameably we behaved ourselves in the midst of you. The verse noted earlier in verse 3, our exhortation is not of error, nor of uncleanness, nor of guile, would relate to Paul's manner of life. All through this passage, Paul is careful to live in such a way that he can make appeal to his own example. Holily, justly, unblameably, holily, righteously, unblameably, we conducted ourselves, we behaved ourselves in the midst of you. I was not seeking material gain. In fact, I didn't even accept support from you. There are two churches, two congregations, from whom Paul did not accept financial support. Thessalonica is one and Corinth is the other. To Corinth, Paul writes, I robbed other churches to do you service. 2 Corinthians 11:8. In 1 Corinthians 9, he shows I had the right to receive support. I had the right to accept support, but I didn't exercise that right in order that I might present the gospel to you without charge and in order that there might not be the basis for any criticism. The whole passage then is permeated with a certain manner of life. We didn't use a cloak of covetousness. We didn't hide our real motive behind a guise or disguise. We came seeking your best interest. And then let's look at the motivation of his life. This is very, very important. Go back with me again to verse 4. The verse we looked at with regard to the message, we see also something of the motive. For even as we've been approved of God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God who proveth our hearts. Paul, what's your primary motivation? You want a following in Thessalonica? You want to have the praise of the people there and have a following there? There are people in Thessalonica who love Paul. But Paul's concern is not that they would be disciples of Paul, but disciples of Christ. And he insists in verse 4, not as pleasing men, but God who proveth our own hearts. Let's just take a minute to turn together and go over to Galatians chapter 1. There's some things out of Galatians 1 I wanted to bring into this morning's lessons anyway. Paul said, Galatians 1, 8 and 9, though we are an angel from heaven, preach unto you any other gospel than that which we've preached unto you, let him be anathema. As I said before, so say I now again, if any man preach unto you any other gospel than that which we've preached unto you, let him be anathema. Now let's watch what follows that. Paul pronounces the anathema, the curse of heaven, against any who preach any other gospel. And so as we stressed this morning, our concern needs to be not with our way, but his way. And the gospel that's been revealed. No other will do. But look at what Paul says after that in Galatians chapter 1 at verse 10. For am I now, literally or mentally underscore the word now. He's just said, if you preach any other gospel, well, let that one be anathema. Am I now seeking the favor of men or of God? His Galatian opponents had said he's a man pleaser. He preaches the cross when it suits him, but circumcision when that seems to be more propitious. That's not true.
If anybody preaches any other gospel, let him be anathema. Am I now seeking to please men or God? Or am I now striving to please men? If I were still pleasing men, I should not be the servant of Christ. Paul, what's your real motivation? I'm trying to please God. If I have those in Thessalonica that I love and who love me well enough, but that's not my primary motivation, and I'm certainly not seeking the following, and I'm certainly not seeking to draw away disciples after me. There are means and methods of evangelism that would sometimes draw away disciples after the one doing the discipling. True in our day, true even in ancient times. Not so with Paul. May it not be so with us. My primary motivation is to please God, and I'm moved by that. Look at his motivation in relation to them. He is not seeking what they might provide him with, but he's rather seeking their best good. Look at the two examples. Look first at verse 7, and then look again at verse 11. In verse 7, you have the example of a nurse with her children, or in one rendering, a nursing mother. In verse 11, you have the example of the father with his children. Paul, what's your motivation in relation to Thessalonians? Great love. Great love for them. I'm seeking their best good, as a parent would his or her children. Read with me at verse 7. But we were gentle in the midst of you, as when a nurse cherisheth her own children, or a nursing mother her own children. Look at verse 8. This is one of the great passages in this section. Being affectionately desirous of you, we were well pleased to impart unto you not the gospel of God only, but our own souls, because you become very dear to us. We did not simply present a message in word, but we gave ourselves not the gospel of God only, and that's plenty, but our own selves, because you will become very dear unto us, being affectionately desirous of you. We imparted unto you not the gospel of God only, but our own selves, because you will become very dear unto us. It's an overstatement. It's a kind of hyperbole, but it contains truth. They don't care how much you know till they know how much you care. Paul cared. As the nurse with her children, he was gentle with the Thessalonians, seeking their good, not his own. To my mind, and I guess part of this depends upon our own vantage point to some extent, but verse 11 contains one of the most touching figures to me, and one with which I can identify. As you know how we dealt with each one of you, personal, individual concern, each one of you. How does a father deal with his children? Does he just order in the troops at the beginning of the day and hand down a mandate and just speak to them in the aggregate? No, because each child is different. So Dad really ought to get off with little Johnny and Johnny alone sometimes and go fishing, or take little Susie to eat lunch with him and spend a little time with each child individually. Now that's a challenge, and that's demanding. But I think that's a part of parenting, because the parent is concerned about each child. It may be out in this big, seemingly impersonal world, we might get the feeling I'm kind of like a number on an IBM card, or a sort of digit in a decimal system, and that's all there is to it. But not in the family. Not with a good father. Even if there are a number of children, he deals with each one of you, because each child is so different. And that's what Paul said. I dealt with you that way. Verse 11, even as you know how we dealt with each one of you, as a father with his own children, exhorting you and encouraging you and testifying to the end that you should walk worthily of God, who calleth you into His own kingdom and glory. Individual concern, great love. In the book of Hosea, there are two major figures showing God's love for Israel. Here is the husband loving the wife. In the case of Israel, a wife who's been unfaithful. There's another figure in the book of Hosea, though, that is very touching to me. In the 11th chapter, God says, I taught you to walk. I stretched out my hands to a little slave boy. And out of all the boys of earth that I could have had for my son, I chose a nation of slaves over in Egypt, and I taught you how to walk. And every parent who's ever watched those first faltering and uncertain steps, the unsteady, unstable gait of the little one with every step being an adventure, and here's Daddy extending his hands and assuring the child everything's going to be all right, can identify with the picture in Hosea chapter 11. God is the Father. And Israel, that little slave boy in Egypt, that's the son He's chosen. And now here Paul says, that's the way I dealt with you. What about your ministry in Thessalonica, Paul? Do you belong with those unscrupulous Greeks who gather at places like Mars Hill in Athens, or at various points in Corinth or in Thessalonica or Philippi? And the Greek mind, thrilled with the rhetorician and the orator and his powers, will gather there, and unscrupulous people take advantage of that, and they get a following, and they derive a certain degree of fame and gain from all of that. Is that where we put Paul, Silas, Timothy? Not for a moment. I preach the gospel of God to you in much conflict, he says early in this paragraph. Much agon, agonia, kin to our word agony. I was shamefully treated before at Philippi, as you know. And I preached the gospel to you in much conflict, in much agony, in much agon. And our exhortation was not of error, nor of uncleanness, nor of God, but we've been entrusted of God with the gospel, and we preached unto you, not as pleasing men, but God, who judgeth our hearts. He's the heart searcher. There's something else I want us to see, and I'm glad we've moved to about verse 5 and 6. Look at that with me. For neither at any time were we found using words of flattery. I think that Carnegie wrote some things that are true in how to win friends and influence people. But one of the key things is, why do you seek to win friends and influence people? Paul is motivated by genuine love for the people and a desire to please God and not men. I didn't use words of flattery. I didn't use a cloak of covetousness. He goes on to say, God is witness. Look at verse 6. Let's all look at that. Nor seeking glory of men, neither from you nor from others, when we might have claimed authority as apostle of Christ. We did not seek the glory of men. A couple of motives we can scratch off the list. Paul was not seeking monetary gain. He did not even accept support from this church. And if you want a fuller commentary on that, just read through 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. He emphasizes that we set an example. And we didn't eat any man's bread for naught, but in labor and travail we work night and day, that we might not be chargeable to you. Here's another motive that you can cross off the list. We did not seek the glory of men. And I'd like for you to make a note right here, mentally or otherwise. If your mental notes are like mine, maybe you need to jot it down. John 5:44. Maybe you've sometimes wondered why some people just wouldn't believe. The evidence seems so compelling. In a Bible class this morning, we were studying John 12. And there were people there who saw the signs, the miracles, and they still didn't believe. The signs did not compel faith, though they produced evidence for it. John 5:44, how can you believe? You who receive glory one of another and the glory of the only God you seek not. Listen to that again. How can you believe? You who seek glory one of another. The glory-seeking attitude is a deterrent to faith. And some are unbelievers because of their own pride. Paul said, we didn't seek the glory of men. We weren't looking for the praise and plaudits of the crowd. We weren't trying to feather our own nest. God is witness, ye also, how holily and justly and unblameably we behaved ourselves. And our concern was genuine, and it was personally expressed. As a nurse or nursing mother with her children, and as a father with his children, so we exhorted and admonished each one of you that you might enjoy fully the blessings and benefits of the kingdom into which he's called us. Verse 12. Paul's message of life, the gospel, verse 4, with which he's been entrusted. Paul's manner of life, and that permeates the whole passage. Paul, Silas, Timothy, the teachers, the preachers, the missionaries in Thessalonica were exemplary in life. Not a breath of criticism with validity could be brought against their lives. And in addition to that, we have Paul's motive of life. Not pleasing men, but God, who searches and tries our hearts. And with regard to his motivation toward them, he was seeking their good, like a father with his own children. Now, we have a great work to do. It's the work of evangelism. The message we have mentioned here, but the motive and the manner we have also here. And in great teaching, message and motive, or message and manner, marry, and they're blended. And we speak truth in love, Ephesians 4:15. And let's envision the Wilshire Church, an evangelistic church, concerned about Guatemala, but not just Guatemala, concerned about radio work in Russia and elsewhere, but not just that, concerned about evangelism right here in Oklahoma City, and concerned about speaking truth in love, being true to the message, but being true also to the motivation and the manner of life that is so powerfully demonstrated in the great paragraph we've looked at tonight in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. It may be that you've not turned from idols to God, to serve a living and true God, and to wait for His Son, even Jesus. It may be that the idol of self is at the center of your life, and you serve that with a great devotion. Or perhaps it's pleasure. Or maybe it's something else, mammon, the material, the mundane. And we're urging you to search your heart tonight, and if you need to come to Him, to believe in Jesus with all your heart, to turn, to repent of sin. That word repent translates the word metanoia. Brother Charles Robertson used to say that means get yourself a new mind. Change your will in regard to sin. Turn from sin. Confess with the mouth Jesus is Lord. Romans 10:9-10. And upon that acknowledgement, be baptized into His death for the remission of your sins. And thus give your heart and life to Him. And thereafter, realize you've been entrusted with the gospel. And it's your high privilege to speak truth in love. If you need to come back to Him, now's the time to do it. We would urge you to come now while we stand and while we sing.